And this is episode 39 for June 26th, the year 2007. We're going to get started this week by taking a look at ratings and censorship in the movie, specifically in America, but that's all that really matters, right? There's no international listeners. This internet thing is only within American borders. But we'll talk about this and also in future weeks cover it in some more depth. We'll have a trivia question like we always do. And I'll give you an idea of how you can be the new teacher in the hood if for some reason the only teaching job you can get is in the inner city. We'll talk about how you can effectively motivate the young adults with whom you've been charged. Our top six list this week is all about political satire. And in the Film Buffs Dictionary, we'll talk about this thing called masks and filters and this idea of shooting day for night and what that all means, how you can change the look of a film by putting things in front of the camera. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and I understand, Stephen, you've taken over some censorship duties on this episode as of 39, right?
That's right, I have.
I got to tell you, I think you're completely unqualified for this position. Who are you, the morality? You shouldn't job. We free expression on the podcast, equal part of the and look, Stephen, we all try and everything fair. We're I don't think you should this position of power.
I'm sorry, I think I missed some of what you said there. Maybe we'll repeat it in the next segment for us. Let's just get started here, huh? Rating movies and deciding who can see what has sort of been an interesting and controversial thing that's been an issue for pretty much as long as films have existed. So we're going to take a look at, particularly in America, looking at censorship and rating systems for motion pictures. So this is going to apply mainly to American films and films being shown in America, so I apologize if you're an international listener. But this topic is also important because it's definitely influenced the films that America has made. Obviously, if you couldn't show a film in America, it wasn't likely that an American studio was going to make it, so hopefully it'll be of some interest to everybody. But unfortunately, we have to get started with a little bit of legal discussion, which may not be the most interesting thing to movie lovers, but it's going to require us to talk about it because the way that movies and the legal system interact is going to really set the discussion for whether or not you can have censored films or have a rating system or how the studios are going to react, that kind of thing. So the first thing is to talk a little bit about the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, which basically guarantees freedom of speech, freedom of press, that kind of thing. But, you know, it's something that kind of gets talked about a lot, but I think maybe a lot of people don't realize how much sort of the application of the First Amendment has changed over the years. You know, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments in the U.S. Constitution, weren't really originally conceived as applying to the states. They applied to the federal government for the most part, but states were by and large allowed to do what they wanted to. So, for instance, in the early days of America, states were allowed to have official state religions. It was just the federal government, our national government, that couldn't have a specific state religion or endorse a specific religion. And it's not until after the Civil War and the passage of the 14th Amendment that this is going to change. And essentially, it's not even really until the early to mid-20th century that the courts are going to begin applying the Bill of Rights to the states. They basically do this through the 14th Amendment, which says that states have to give all people due process under the law before they can deprive them of life and liberty and property. And so that idea of due process before depriving them of liberty is going to end up through a long and complex series of court decisions mean that states will be subject to First Amendment regulations. But in the early days of film, they're not. Remember, film's going to begin in the 1890s. That's really when commercial exhibition of film begins, and by the early 1900s is going to be in full swing. And so, in 1915, there is a very influential Supreme Court decision called Mutual Film Corp. versus the Industrial Commission of Ohio. And essentially, the Supreme Court in this case rules that films are commerce, and they are not considered speech, and thus they do not really deserve protection under freedom of speech claims. So this was pretty common until, again, the second part, maybe, of the 20th century. The Supreme Court is not going to consider a lot of things speech speech that today we'll consider speech. And so movies are one of these things. They're a business, and you have no particular constitutional right to free expression of businesses, and so states can censor films if they want to. So essentially what the case was about was that Ohio had this commission that regulated what films could and couldn't be shown in Ohio, and the Supreme Court says that this is fine, there's nothing illegal about this. And so this is going to pretty much typify the early days of film in America. They're going to be local cities or states will just have their own film boards, and they'll decide what can and cannot be shown. Now, sort of the mainstream movies, those produced by the big Hollywood studios, are not going to really show explicit sex or nudity because, you know, they've got to play everywhere in the country, and so they're going to try and keep track of all these different standards and make movies that are not too offensive. But it's interesting to note that sort of on the fringes from the very beginning, pornographic movies exist, though they're pretty much illegal in just about everywhere, but also a lot of other independent movies, especially before the studios really have complete control over exhibition and showing of movies by the sound era or so. I mean, these early days are kind of a more free-for-all, so there's lots of these weird little movies that you don't think of that have nudity and stuff. You don't think of there being nudity in films in the 1910s, but absolutely there were films. They just weren't that widely seen, or they're kind of a little more of an underground phenomenon. What happens, though, is starting in the 1920s, there begins to be a real public push for Hollywood to do something about the sense of immorality that is going to be coming from Hollywood. And part of this is caused by all these revelations. And there's right in the very early 1920s, there's several big scandals involving several Hollywood stars. For instance, Mary Pickford got divorced, which in the early 20s, which wasn't that big of a deal. But a few weeks later, she married her on-screen star, Douglas Fairbanks. And so, I mean, these are two people who kind of represented sort of innocence and purity and goodness in films. I mean, Pickford especially. And, you know, she's marrying her on-screen star just a few weeks after divorcing her husband. That's going to be fairly shocking to audiences of the 1920s who, you know, can put two and two together and realize that these guys were probably having an affair before Pickford got divorced. There's also some scandals involving the actor Fatty Arbuckle, who gets charged with manslaughter, is eventually cleared with all these drug implications, and he's going to be more or less banned from Hollywood. But all these different scandals that come up, some more drug scandals and stuff, are basically going to make the studios really terrified of federal regulation. And so, you know, they've been okay with these local jurisdictions, but they don't want the federal government to start, you know, can start reviewing all their films. They don't like the current system, really. So they form the Motion Pictures Producers and Distributors Association, which is later going to be known as the Motion Picture Association of America, the MPAA as we know it today. And they're going to hire a guy named Will Hayes in 1922 to run this new outfit. And it's going to just essentially be the industry trade group. All the major studios are part of it. And this trade group is going to try and promote the idea that movies are fine, that Hollywood isn't a corrupt place. And they hire Will Hayes to run it because Hayes is this upstanding kind of moral guy. He'd been the postmaster general, right? So you fear that anyone who's the postmaster general can't be too bad. But the fact is that in the 1920s, this MPPDA isn't going to have a lot of teeth. Hayes, I think he's generally characterized as a guy who meant well, but he wasn't too good at actually getting anyone to do what he wanted. And so he's going to issue a list of, like, very famously in the late 20s, issued a list of do's and don'ts to the studios, the things they can and can't show. But they don't have to follow it, and so nobody does, because, you know, even while there are these claims that, you guys need to be more moral, also still these, you know, sex sells. These gangster movies in the 20s sell, and especially in the big cities where maybe the morals are a little different than in rural America.
We should probably interject that in the mainstream films being made, although they did push the boundaries beyond what they would be allowed to do, say, in the late 30s or the 40s or something, still pretty tame by today's standards, probably.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, that's a good point. Again, within these mainstream movies, you're not going to see any sex scenes, for instance. You're not going to see any nudity, for the most part. It is kind of weird, though, if you do see, you do see maybe nudity more than you would expect in some of these movies, but it's not going to be very sexual in nature. It's just a little different than the standards today. So, yeah, but in the early 30s, there is continued outcry, particularly as we switch over to sound films and people become more and more concerned. And once you have sort of salacious dialogue, that makes things even a little trickier. And so there's especially a Catholic outcry in the early 30s, and it leads to the creation of something called the Production Code by this industry trade group that Hayes is headed, and it will be called the Hayes Code, sort of in his honor. And the Hayes Code is adopted in 1930, and it's this really kind of, you know, especially at today's standards, this kind of strange set of things that you can and can't do in movies. It has three general principles, and they are, number one, no picture shall be produced that will lower the moral standards of those who see it. Hence, the sympathy of the audience should never be thrown to the side of crime, wrongdoing, evil, or sin. So you can't make movies that anyway glorify criminals or that would encourage people to become criminals. Number two, correct standards of life, subject only to the requirements of drama and entertainment, shall be presented. So not only can you not show illegal actions, but you can't in any way, shape, or form show an incorrect way of life. And so this is going to be much more of a sort of moral judgment. And the third is simply that law, natural or human, shall not be ridiculed, nor shall sympathy be created for its violation. So again, another sort of very moral kind of admonition. You know, you can't show people... You can show people breaking the law, but you can't ridicule the law, and you have to see people being punished. And there are a bunch of other sort of more explicit things that you can and can't do. Most famous is probably one that talks about what you can and can't show in terms of sex, which says, excessive and lustful kissing, lustful embraces, suggestive postures and gestures are not to be shown. I mean, the excessive and lustful kissing is particularly a classic line from the code. But in the early 1930s, it's not that effective. It's put out there, and the studios say, great, we're going to keep releasing the movies we want. It's good PR, but nothing else. Well, in 1934, a bunch of Catholics get together, and they form the National Legion for Decency, which isn't actually a specifically Catholic organization. Lots of other religious groups are going to be allowed to join and that kind of thing. But it is sort of initially a Catholic kind of thing, and it's going to include this big push among particularly Catholics to not see these sorts of immoral films. You know, so you go to Mass and you say this oath that you will not see these films that are condemned by the National Legion for Decency. Well, this scares the heck out of the studios because they suddenly say, okay, so these guys are going to just start boycotting, you know, movies en masse. We can't handle millions of Catholics not going to see our movies. We need to do something about it. So that same year that the Legion for Decency is formed, the studios create the Production Code Authority to give their production code some teeth. So this is 4 years after the code was officially adopted that they create this authority. And the authority is going to be a body that's basically part of the MPPDA, that trade body headed by Hayes. And so studios are going to all agree that before they release any film, they're going to submit it to the Production Code Authority, which will give them a certificate saying it's okay to show this movie. This movie follows the code. And the guy who's going to run the Production Code Authority is a guy named Joseph Breen. And Breen, unlike Hayes, is going to be very strict about it, and he is going to be very happy to just send movies back, to not give them approval, that kind of thing. And Breen is going to just have really an unprecedented level of control. I mean, he's allowed to review scripts and force alterations to them. If he doesn't like them, he gets to sort of have a lot of control over the final cut of a movie. He can say, look, either you cut this scene out, or it's not getting approval from the Production Code Authority. And starting in 1934, the studios simply are not going to release any movies that are not shown approval by the Production Code Authority. And in fact, it's going to apply to all sorts of things, not just, you know, maybe your movie's not objectionable, but maybe the way you advertise it is. In particular, there's a very famous case where Breen and Howard Hughes, the airplane mogul, got into a huge dispute over a film called The Outlaw that Hughes had financed and was promoting because the advertising in particular really focused on Jane Russell's cleavage, and Breen just felt it was completely inappropriate, and he thought that the movie was just going to, you know, this be this sort of sexually charged kind of thing, and so Breen just blocked its release for years. It took about 4 or 5 years for Hughes to finally convince him that the movie was not as salacious as the movie's poster made it out to see, and you know, that kind of demonstrates...
There's a great scene in The Aviator by Martin Scorsese that kind of touches on that subject, and it's a pretty hilarious scene there where Hughes is trying to convince the board that it's okay.
Yeah, and I mean, Hughes does end up eventually winning that fight, but it, you know, takes 4 or 5 years, so that's sort of strict control that the Production Code Authority has over films that are released. And there will be some, you know, independent films made and released outside of the Production Code Authority without its approval, But remember that this is the time where studios control the vast majority of theaters, and so theaters were not going to show any of these films either. So for the most part, American films from really 1934 through the 1960s are going to adhere to this code. So in the next part, we're going to talk more about the production code and how it influenced movies through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the early 60s. And we'll talk sort of about how it eventually came to not exist.
But also, while you're waiting for us to continue that discussion, go to the website, and, you know, every Thursday for weeks now, we've been looking at the early days, the late 1920s, and just different aspects of what the movie industry and the movie scene and everything was like at that time. And so as we're running these segments about censorship, might as well look at that and that picture in 1929. So for the next 3 weeks, that series of posts will be on this subject.
10 questions, 10 deadly challenges, 10 wrong answers. The stakes have never been higher. The gauntlet has never been thrown lower. The knife has never been able to cut so much tension. Welcome to another edition of Movie or Banned. Our first contestant is Stephen Keller. Hi, Stephen Keller.
Hi, Mom. Hi, everybody.
Hi. Are you ready to play Movie or Banned?
Heck yes, I am. I'm going to win that toaster oven.
Okay, well, you know the rules, but let me repeat them for our audience. I'll give you 10 names, and each name will be the name of a movie or the name of a band. And your task is to identify which is which. But because we're so nice here on Movie or Band, and also because we have this weird format to try to fit into, we're going to be nice and give you all 10 questions ahead of time and give you till the end of the show to decide how to guess. So here you go. Your 10 names of movies or bands will be: number 1, Savage Garden; number 2, The Fabulous Baker Boys; number 3, Trout Fishing in America; number 4, Smilla's Sense of Snow; number 5, Thanks to Gravity; number 6, Smiling Fish and Goat on Fire; number 7, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band; number 8, The Doors; number 9, Wings; number 10, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Now give me a prediction here. How many of these things do you think you can get?
I'd go with at least 12.
12. 12 out of 10. That's not bad. That would be 120% that would come in second place for what we've ever had on this show, Movie or Band. Stay tuned. Get back to us at the end of the show.
Anyone who decides to go into teaching does it for the purest of reasons, to shape young minds, to make some money, that kind of thing. But invariably, if you're a truly dedicated teacher, your first couple of assignments are likely going to be all about having to be the new teacher in the hood. So that's why this week's how-to is going to focus on dealing with those troubled inner-city kids when you go and have to be the new teacher at that school and really have to learn to motivate a class full of people that don't want to deal with it. And by the way, these tips surprisingly will work well for, say, like a bunch of prep school kids or something. Turns out that kids are more or less the same wherever you go. Just, you know, there's fewer drug dealers in the prep schools, but, you know, just as many suicides and random deaths, that kind of thing. So the first thing you need to know is when you become the new teacher, of course, there's going to be some kind of hazing. The kids will make fun of you. They'll throw stuff at you. They won't pay attention. They won't do what you say, this sort of thing. So what you need to do is just keep your cool. You can't let them see a sweat. Now, sooner or later, you're going to be trying to go along with your preset, boring lesson plans, and they're going to crack you. They're going to come up with something that just really gets to you, and you're going to lose it and just start shouting and go crazy. And then, aha, they'll got you, and they'll laugh. And you'll break down in the teacher's lounge. You'll be like, I got to quit. But don't. This is where you can go ahead and regain your cool, and it's time to change your game plan. So, you want to go ahead and just change everything. In the next day during class, you're going to make a big dramatic gesture of just throwing away all your textbooks, throwing away the lesson plan, all that. You're going to be like, all right, we're not doing it the normal way. We're not doing it the way the man wants us to. We're going to keep it real. Kids like to say things like that. Keep it real. I think that's like hip. Anyway, so do something like come up with nicknames for everybody. So you'll have some kind of nickname. They'll all have nicknames. And if you could maybe create some sort of special club that plays on this nickname, you know, then they'll really be into it. Because, well, you know, for inner city kids, they love clubs. I mean, that's what gangs are, right? Just they're basically clubs for teenagers. So same kind of deal. You're going to have nicknames and maybe some kind of like special color you guys all. I don't know. You can work on it. But at the same time, treat them like adults, you know, be like, you know, hey, listen, I get that you guys are more mature than the school system thinks you are, so from now on, you're going to earn this on your own. And then you go ahead and unveil your new lesson plans. You got to really communicate to them on their level. You have to relate to them. So do stuff like use dice, gambling games, to teach math and probability, because kids love playing craps. Or if you're teaching, say, poetry or English, you can go ahead and use rap music. You know, I mean, kids love rap music, and you can say, like, look, here's how Snoop Dogg is a lot like Robert Frost. I mean, they're very similar if you stop and think about it. Note that you can go and use Bob Dylan for the same purpose, because if there's one thing that gang members love, it's the American folk stylings of Bob Dylan. I mean, how many roads must a man walk down? Really, if there's one thing that kids have, it's they got the Notorious B.I.G. in one hand and the latest Bob Dylan album in the next. So you can go and do that and just analyze the music and how does it make you feel and how does it compare to great literature. And you start doing these methods, you start offering prizes for them for completing their assignments, you know, money or little trinkets, trips outside of school, you start holding classes outdoors, all that kind of good stuff, and the kids will come around, they'll start really and truly respecting you and start really paying attention, and they'll say things like, wow, I never realized that this actually related to my life, because that's the major problem with schools, is they don't relate well enough to the lives of children. I mean, these kids, all they really need is to know how Shakespeare is relevant to their life, and they'll just, of course, fall in love with it. Now, you'll also have to deal with a lot of crises during your initial tenure. First and foremost, you're almost certainly going to have some kind of personal crisis. Your wife, girlfriend, husband, whatever, fiance, best friend, there's going to be some tension because you'll have to be spending all this time at school and dealing with the kids on a personal level. You'll have to be spending money on all this stuff, and it's going to really upset the other person in your life. And that person will just leave you. Well, you know what? Nuts to them. Just go ahead and let them leave and don't worry too much about the other person in your life. You got to really just devote yourself to the kids. It's the most important thing. Now, there will also be some kind of crisis involving the kids. It might be a suicide, or might be get killed by drug dealers, that kind of thing. Dealing with this can be really tricky, especially if, you know, you're a new teacher, you're not that good at this kind of thing, you don't know anything about grief counseling, and, you know, it'll cause the kids to be like, you know, why do I want to bother? Why do I want to sit here in class? When people are dying, what do I want to learn about this? So what you do is, you know, you put on some Tupac or Dylan or whatever it is that the kids love, and you really just talk about how it deals with life and death, and then you sign an essay about the fragility of life, and sure enough, I'll bet that one kid you couldn't reach, now finally motivated by the death of his or her best friend, will use this essay as a chance to really express and explore.
Sure. I'd like to interject something here that really worked out for me when I was teaching in the Bronx, and that is, you know when these are going to happen, these crises are going to happen. I mean, they never happen prior to your acceptance. So that kind of narrows it down a little. But after that, you pretty much know that at some point in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., 4 a.m., whatever, one of your students, the one that is just was holding out against you just that extra little bit, is going to come to your door and ring your doorbell, and because you're the only person that he can turn to, or she, or... So I got kind of annoyed by this after a while. It's like, come on, I need to get my sleep. You know, oh, there's another kid who's coming to my doorbell. He's the last person to turn to. So what I did was I actually adjusted my sleep schedule. It's like right around, I think, February, maybe as early as December, somewhere in there. December through February are really prime crises months. And what I did is I just kind of changed my hours. And you can do this because the school is very flexible. You say, you know, class outdoors or whatever. You just, all right, fine, we're going to do classes at 10 p.m. or something. They'll go along with that. So you hold classes then. Then you're awake when the crisis happens and they come to the door. And it really helped me with my personal sleep patterns because I really need my sleep.
Yeah, that's a great tip, Sam. Thanks for sharing that. And you hit it on the head. It's going to happen sometime between December and February because that's when the initial, or as we call it sometimes, the false crisis really hits. Because toward the spring months, in getting into the early summer months, what's going to happen is the real crisis. And this is going to be the crisis that's going to, you know, threaten your job. You know, you're holding classes outdoors or at 10 p.m. or whatever. That's fine for a while, but once the man gets wind of it, things are going to head south real quick. I mean, you're going to really just raise the ire of the faculty or the school board or the principal or the superintendent or the PTA or the local garden club or whatever it is.
That's right, because if there is one thing that adults cannot stand, it's students who are learning things and are happy about learning.
Yeah, especially if they're learning in an unconventional way. It's just terrible. So anyway, the man's going to come down on you hard, and there's going to be this whole group of parents or administrators or whatever who are out to get you. And so you might want to know how you have to prepare for that big hearing that you finally have to do. And the answer is, you don't have to do jack squat, because the kids are going to show up en masse without you having to do anything. And they're going to stand up and say how much you mean to them and how much you matter and how important you are to their lives. And that will finally crack the icy hearts of the cruel people who are out for you, and you'll be able to keep your job in a really emotional moment. So the kids will save the day, and then it's time for the last day of class, and you'll have that letter in your hand that's the job offer that you accepted somewhere else because, you know, you were going to get fired, you're going to get canned by the school board, so you already took that job, and the kids are all sad to see you go, and you have that letter, you say, you know what, sorry, I already took it. But then, as you look over their faces, you take out that letter and you burn it or you throw it away and you say, I'm staying here, I'm working right with you. Then the frame freezes and you're done. That's pretty much it. And once you've survived your first year, it'll be much, much easier the next year. Well, it may not be. I mean, you may have to go to like a different school district or, you know, hopefully you don't have to deal with a sequel. But if you do, same tips will probably apply.
Our top six list for this week, we're pretty excited about. It's political satires. My number six is probably the least well-known of my six, and it's called The President's Analyst, made in 1967, starring James Coburn. This is one weird movie, seriously weird. I can't even describe how weird it is, but it is also very funny. The idea is this guy is hired to be the president's therapist. And, you know, because the president has a lot on his mind. He has all kinds of secrets and conspiracies going on, and they're upsetting to deal with. So he has a therapist, and during these sessions, he tells the therapist, the analyst, that's the Coburn character, tells him all kinds of secrets, and ultimately he's told enough secrets to be a danger to a conspiracy going on. And so people want him dead. The president doesn't, but people are after him because of what he knows. And the great thing about this movie is how it satirizes absolutely everything. A good political satire can take one kind of issue and simplify it, but this just kind of does the opposite and just attacks everything. Everything, especially, it was made in the 60s, especially things that were on the public mind in the 60s, where you have this duel between establishment and anti-establishment forces, and you have breakdown of nuclear family values and some changing social values and all these things go on in the 60s. Well, this movie takes all sides of all these issues on and just makes fun of everybody. It's pretty hilarious. It makes fun of psychotherapy, of politics just in general and everything. So, you know, it's weird, but it is very, very smart and cutting about what it tries to do, and gosh, very funny.
That sounds cool. You're right. I haven't heard of it, but I might have to put that on my Netflix queue because it does sound very intriguing. Well, my number six, and I'm going to go ahead and just mention straight off that you'll see with a couple of my picks that I particularly respect political satires that are really timely and topical. And that's why I was a big fan of Wag the Dog from 1997 by Barry Levinson. I mean, it was sort of, in a way, in a sense, a little topical almost by accident. But it's I think probably most people have seen it. Great script by David Mamet. But basically takes place in the mid-90s about a president who stages a fake war in order to divert attention from a sex scandal that he's embroiled in. And, of course, this was released right around the same time that the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And so it seemed particularly topical and timely at the time, and it's still a very sharp script. I mean, gosh, David Mamet is such a great writer, and this is a really good Levinson film. Unfortunately, we don't seem to be getting many good Levinson films these days, but, boy. Again, here's another movie that does kind of satire and kind of pretty much cut just about everybody involved in the political process. It's a fairly cynical movie, and I think it's a little too cynical, honestly. Some of these political satires, I think, are a little too, I don't know, a little too quick to just slam everyone involved in politics. But here's a great, great, fun movie that's just witty and clever. Even if I don't quite like the way it goes toward the end of the film, I still really enjoy it. I just love the idea of faking a war. And Woody Harrelson is the guy they get to be the hero of their fake war with Albania is a particularly inspired casting choice.
Yeah, I love Wag the Dog. I think, something you didn't mention, I think this is one of Dustin Hoffman's most entertaining performances. It's just a great performance. He's the guy hired to help stage and fake this war. An infectiously enthusiastic person, about just so proud of the work he's doing, and doesn't really ingest the ramifications of what it is. He just loves the work itself. Great performance, and yeah. Absolutely love the dialogue. This is one of David Mamet's stronger scripts, I think, in terms of dialogue, and that's really saying a lot. My number five. Okay, well, let me set this up for you, see if you can guess what this is. It's a showcase for Peter Sellers, because he plays three different roles in this comedy about nuclear war. Of course I'm talking about The Mouse That Roared, right? You saw that coming, right, Stephen, didn't you? The Mouse That Roared.
Well, yeah, actually.
You knew that was coming. 1959.
Because, of course, you set it up and
made it too obvious. Oh, well. It's about this eensy-teensy little country facing an economic crisis, and so they decide, hey, here's how we can get out of this and get some money flowing into the country. We'll declare war on the United States, lose, and rake in all the foreign aid for reconstruction. What a great plan. So they send out some guys with bows and arrows into New York, and, you know, without saying really the details, they ultimately win the war, and so then they get stuck with having to supply aid to the United States. I just have to say the premise, really, that pretty much does it. It's just a hilarious idea. And the execution is just great, because obviously Peter Sellers is a brilliant comic, very flexible guy. He's just besides the fact that he can play multiple roles in films, he can really absolutely convincingly take on a different comic style. That's pretty tough. You know, you think of any number of comedians, they have one or two different kinds of attitudes and comic personas that they can do, and they are popular because they do it really well. Well, Peter Sellers can absolutely disappear inside somebody. In fact, he was fond of saying that he has no personality, and it's his characters that he portrays that do. Really interesting movie here.
Yeah, now I have two Sellers movies on my list a little bit later, so we'll see if people can guess what those are, but yeah, I mean, I'll talk more about how great he is, but yeah, I think it's interesting you mentioned that he doesn't have a specific comic persona. I think it's because he's just being a great actor and really disappearing into his roles. You know, he's a comic who is also just a tremendous actor, capable of giving total movie star caliber performances, and I think that's why he's so successful. Well, my number five pick is one that I just love for what it does with some of its basic themes, and that's the Alexander Payne film Election from 1999, which really scales down the political satire to look at elections through the lens of a high school student body election. And this movie just has a stellar performance from Reese Witherspoon. If you ever start wondering, you know, you see some crappy romantic comedy starring Witherspoon, you know, watch Election, watch Pleasantville, watch Walk the Line, and remember that she is probably one of the most talented actresses working right now. I mean, just especially Election. I don't know if she's given a better performance than this one, in which she stars as the sort of overachieving girl who is just completely and utterly ruthless and terrible in her quest to become the student body president. And she runs up against a teacher played by Matthew Broderick, who is apparently the only person who sees, you know, he sees her as the embodiment of all that's wrong with society, and so he enlists another guy to run against her and start trying to be his campaign manager. And I love the way it just goes completely insane. It's a pretty dark comedy, but it's wonderful for how much it has to say about politics, because I think a lot of times, you know, you take these sort of big, weighty issues and they're hard to deal with. It's hard to deal with the personalities involved in, say, presidential elections, because we feel so strongly about the issues. But here, by making it about a student body election, it doesn't really matter who wins or loses. No one cares about the school, right? I mean, no one cares about student government at a school, but here we get to see exactly what it is that elections do to people. And it's a strange process if you think about elections. You know, we're going to pick the person to lead us by making them go through this tremendously weird and difficult game, and what does that do to the kind of people who can succeed at this? You know, there's just so much to say about Election. I love it. It's a great movie, and it's one that really sits with you and stays with you after you've seen it.
I gotta make a snooty kind of sound at you. Yeah, Election, I didn't really like it. I don't think it's that great of a movie, but I also simultaneously somehow think it is a brilliant political satire, so I'm not really sure how I feel about it. Certainly, I love the political angles, and I think I felt that there was too much excess to it. But I love Reese Witherspoon in this. You have that dead on. I thought when I first saw that movie that, hey, okay, she needs to be at least nominated for an Academy Award. She should probably win it. And then, you know, what happened is she didn't even get nominated. So I was all the more pleased when she kind of got a makeup Oscar for Walk the Line. And
yeah.
I don't know if it was seen as a makeup Oscar at all, but I took it that way. I said, now justice has been
Witherspoon
done
is just so fantastic.
But yeah, her performance in an Election is fantastic. And the movie is probably worth seeing just for that. So number four for me, Duck Soup from 1933. Marx Brothers movie. Some people say it's the best. I don't know if I do exactly, but it's certainly up there. This is another political satire, like my number five pick, about a small fictional nation trying to rescue itself from poverty. In this case, there's this rich woman who agrees to bail it out as long as they appoint the ruler of her own choosing. And not entirely sure I understand why, but she chooses a guy named Rufus T. Firefly, which you may know because that is one of the more famous personas of Groucho Marx, who is really Groucho Marx in the movies. And, you know, the Marx Brothers all had standard personalities, and the names they used for whatever movie they happened to be making were pretty incidental. But, you know, that Rufus T. Firefly, very memorable name there. And meanwhile, a neighboring nation is also a fictional nation, sends in a couple of spies, and they, of course, Harpo and Chico, and so basically it's just a setup for them to do some crazy things, which is just attack everything. They had a real irreverent sense to them, the Marx Brothers, and they were revolutionary in their day. Nobody else was really doing this. There was a lot more respect and reverence for the establishment, for strong figures, whether it be political figures or heads of large corporate entities. A lot more respect in those times than there are now. Now it's just commonplace to just chop off the head that sticks out of the crowd. But the Marx Brothers were attacking these kind of people with a satire that just was not done by anybody else at the time. And I like the way Roger Ebert describes his father taking him to his first Marx Brothers movie. And Ebert said later on he recognized that his father spoke of the Marx Brothers in that tone that says, that somebody got away with something. And they really did. Love Duck Soup, love the Marx Brothers, my number four.
I think satire has to be getting away with something, that it has to be a little daring in order for it to really and truly work. And that's what makes, you know, so much satire hold up so well if it's good, and bad satire just completely doesn't. Which is why maybe I can sound a little more respectable if I try and couch my number four pick in those sorts of terms, because when I tell you that I think the single best film about being an American in the post 9/11 world, to use a terrible turn of phrase, is a spoof of action movies starring a bunch of puppets, you know, you're going to think I'm crazy. But I think Team America, World Police from 2004 by Trey Parker and Matt Stone is my number four pick for top political satires. It's just a wonderful, ridiculous movie that attacks just about both sides of, it's hard to put it in easy terms, but it attacks both the American left and the American right, and argues, as Parker and Stone so often do, for a kind of middle way, this excluded middle that so often gets left out of our discourse. And it was pretty controversial when it was released. I mean, it came out in 2004. This was the year of the Kerry Bush electoral contest, and it came out pretty close to the election, and a lot of people were just upset with Parker and Stone, I guess, even in Hollywood, especially in Hollywood, because they thought, well, you guys are just completely undermining the entire electoral process, making fun of a serious issue. But I actually think the movie does have a pretty good point in terms of what it's arguing for, and really does a great job of capturing, I think, how a lot of Americans kind of feel. Like, you know, a lot of us, I think, feel like we need to do something about this problem with terrorism, but we don't know what to do. And this movie captures that much better than another sort of movie that came out around the same time, the terribly overrated Fahrenheit 9/11, which is proposed, I'm not even sure what exactly, but more simplistic solutions, or any of the other movies that just towed one side or the other. Team America is actually a fairly reasoned approach to the entire issue, and despite that, is just absolutely, completely, and totally hilarious.
Okay, so here's a question. I think Fahrenheit 9/11 was popular because it took a side that some people had. In fact, a lot of people had the side that, hey, Bush is an idiot. Okay, this movie's saying that. It must be brilliant. Team America was attacking both sides, and so nobody had that safe haven. Now,
right.
Do you think that that means that, well, I know what your answer is going to be, but let me pose a question anyway. Do you think that really means that the movie Team America has a reasoned side, or is it just creating humor by attacking everything it can?
No. The thing is, people said, oh, yeah, it's just attacking everybody, but it's not. I mean, the movie has a clear message. I mean, there's like a whole monologue in the movie in which Parker and Stone very clearly spell out the message for you. I'm so surprised that so many critics missed it. I mean, disagree with it or not, Team America makes a specific case for how we should deal with these sorts of things, and it is essentially a middle way. It's a little bit from both sides, and it's not something that I think a lot of people were in the media, at least, wanted to hear, because it didn't sort of fall into that nice one-or-the-other kind of duality.
Okay, well, I haven't seen the movie. I was just curious to hear that opinion. Anyway, my number three, we've already talked about it. It's Wag the Dog from 97. I mentioned Dustin Hoffman before. Robert De Niro is also pretty great in this, too. He's the government spin doctor who hires Hoffman, and what a great couple of actors. Wouldn't you just love to see them doing mammoth dialogue in anything? Back to you.
Well, we've talked about Peter Sellers before, and we'll talk about him again, but my number three pick is perhaps one of the greatest movie performances, and I really believe that, and it's from Sellers in Hal Ashby's 1979 film Being There, in which Sellers plays a man named Chance, who's a gardener, who was sort of this simpleton who lives his entire life in this sheltered environment, and when the owner of the house that he's sort of been tending garden to his entire life passes away, he walks out into the wide world completely unaware of what's going on, and through, you know, the sorts of coincidences that only seem to happen in entertainment, ends up becoming an advisor to the president, and by the film's end is being considered for a run for president. And this movie is just brutal, but still very subtle in the way it just completely demolishes so-called political pundits who offer nothing but, you know, simple sort of half-truths. You know, there's a great scene where he's trying to talk to the president. The president's trying to get ideas from this guy who everyone thinks is so wise, and, you know, he's just saying the dumbest things. Like, he's just basically talking about gardening, and everyone thinks he's using these complicated metaphors about how you have to plant bulbs when the time is right and water them, and they're extrapolating all of this nonsense about, oh, so we have to use diplomacy sometimes and use force. Oh, just hilarious. I mean, not an overt political satire the way some of our other movies are, but certainly does really, really touch on politics and just, man, really just slams political pundits, and I love that. I love it, and it's just such a wonderful film, really anchored by Sellers just completely disappearing into this character, and so many just wonderful moments.
Yeah, I think you liked this movie more than I did, but I did like it a lot. I agree with most of what you're saying. I don't necessarily share your enthusiasm. I maybe have to see it again. I think it's one of those movies that you kind of need to experience and let it sit and digest for a while. Well, my number two is The Great Dictator, and it's Charlie Chaplin's first fully sound film. We mentioned Modern Times earlier on, which is sort of a transitional film. But Charlie Chaplin plays a dual role. What is it about dual roles in political satires? It's kind of weird. But he plays this dual role where he's, one character's this thinly disguised Hitler, and another character's a Jewish barber that just happens to look exactly like him. And so you can probably imagine some of what happens. I mean, obviously there's a bit of inspiration from The Prince and the Pauper here, but only the barest of outlines, really. The heart of this movie is in making a point about the contemporary political climate in 1940. So this is, you know, the war has started, but the U.S. isn't involved. It's very early on. A lot of people still thought they could reason with Hitler and solve this problem through diplomacy. Chaplin was not one of those people, definitely not. And so this film takes on this subject and uses a lot of irony and sarcasm and comic exaggeration, and just pulls out all the stops to exaggerate the evil of the Nazi regime. And there is something scary about this today that's not quite so funny at all, really. He predicted a lot of the things that the Nazis would do, and then they ultimately did, like the purging of the Jewish ghettos and things. So you actually see this in the movie before it happened in real life. And at the time this movie came out, people said it was going too far, but, you know, obviously not. Anyway, still works as an uproarious comedy, and a lot of the humor is just so far over the top, slapsticky kind of stuff. Like, there's a running gag about how this, the Hitler character and this thinly disguised Napoleon character have this meeting, and they have this ongoing competition to try to just be higher up, you know. So they're in barber chairs, and they each want to pump the chair up higher than the other one. And there's just an ongoing gag about them doing this. This is Chaplin stuff. If you have his silent films, you kind of know what he's doing here, except now he uses the full resources that sound gives him, and so he uses gibberish speech to imitate the pep rally kind of speeches, you know, that kind of thing. But razor sharp wit into this. It's a wonderful film.
And it's why it's my number two pick as well.
Oh, good.
Thinking about this, it occurs to me that fascism is sort of a weird, I mean, authoritarian governments in general, but particularly fascism, really are not based on logic and reason. I mean, fascism, be it Nazism or the fascism of Italy, I mean, fascism of the 1930s in Europe is really about pageantry and great symbols and, you know, this call to history, be it the ancient Romans for Italy or these mythical Aryan warrior race that Hitler was into. I mean, it's about this grand majesty. And the only real way, I think, to deflate it is to just make it look ridiculous. And that's what Chaplin does. I think it's one of the things that's so brave about The Great Dictator is that, I mean, you're right, it is an uproarious comedy because, boy, I mean, the Hitler character is named Adenoid Hinkle, to give you an idea of how silly he seems. And, I mean, his competition, like you mentioned, with the Mussolini stand-in, is just makes them both look so completely and utterly foolish. I think it's the only real way that you can deflate fascism is just to completely and totally mock it. And, you know, you mentioned how there's a kind of a creepy undertone to some of the scenes today. And, you know, Chaplin said, had he known the true horrors that were happening and were going to happen to the Jewish people and other people who ended up in the death camps, he might not have done some of the stuff he did. But I don't know, in a sense, I think it's even more powerful because of that. I think one of the things that makes satire so powerful and so great is that it can be used to address really important and serious issues. And, you know, here we have a great example of doing just that by being able to just completely and totally make fun of such an evil and terrible idea. And we're able to really effectively show the audience just how silly and stupid this all is.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that's why that most famous scene in this movie is so famous. And maybe you've seen it even if you haven't seen the movie. It's the one where the Hitler character is doing a ballet with this giant balloon that's painted to look like the world. And so he's just happily prancing around. He's got the whole world in his hands,
right,
basically. And he can bat it this way and that and just kind of... And it just, you're right, it looks ridiculous, but it absolutely symbolizes what he wanted to do. You know what? We picked the same number two. I just know we picked the same number one, so why don't you take a turn in introducing this?
Well, you know how much I feel like if I'm not picking Blade Runner one week, I'm picking Dr. Strangelove, and that's my number one political satire from 1964 by Stanley Kubrick, also starring Peter Sellers in different roles. I think I've probably talked about this scene before in the film, but I'll just mention this as to why I think it's so wonderful, and it's the scene after the nukes have flown, and pretty much both the United States and the Soviet Union are going to be wiped off the face of the planet, and the top U.S. advisors are gathered around talking about what are we going to do. And someone brings up the idea of, you're completely implausible since they have minutes to live, that perhaps they could dig some really deep mine shafts in which they could bring in an assortment of people and repopulate the Earth from within the mine shafts. And then someone mentions, well, what if the Soviets did the same thing? What if they also have mine shafts? And immediately the Americans start fearing the mine shaft gap they're well behind the Soviets on. And, I mean, can you imagine much more of a just completely and perfect summation of the Cold War logic? I mean, the insane logic that was mutually assured destruction right then and there. Everything that was weird and bizarre about the Cold War is in that single scene. And for Kubrick to have made this film in 1964, you know, right maybe just slightly after the very peak of the Cold War, that took some courage. And, you know, I love the movies that can really address their current times, and here's one that does it and just completely rips apart this insane sense of paranoia and fear that pervaded the United States, and I'm sure also the Soviet Union during the Cold War.
Well, let's recap this. Political satires that we love, our top six. Well, my number six was The President's Analyst from 1967. My number five, The Mouse That Roared from 59. Number four, Duck Soup from 1933, The Marx Brothers. Number three, Wag the Dog from 1997. Number two, The Great Dictator from 1940, starring Charlie Chaplin. And number one, Dr. Strangelove from 1964. Half of my entries had dual roles in it for the actors.
Well, that's crazy. Well, my number six is Wag the Dog from 97, directed by Barry Levinson, with a great script by David Mamet. Number five, Election, Alexander Payne's film from 1999. Number four, Team America, World Police, in 2004, by Trey Parker and Matt Stone. Incidentally, I think they're the two best working satirists right now in any medium. Number three, Being There, 1979, by Hal Ashby. Number two, The Great Dictator, 1940, by Charlie Chaplin. And number one, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb, 1964, Stanley Kubrick. So we continue in our Film Buffs Dictionary our discussion of, let's see if I can do this, cinematographic? So anyway, terms about cinematography. You know, actually somebody, I forget who off the top of my head, somebody posted to our allmovietalk.com, the blog there, how I can pronounce it, and I read it, I was like, okay, that's it, that's perfect, and then I forgot it. Oh, you know, it was Jeffrey, so thanks, Jeffrey, I tried, it was close, I'm getting better, I'll look at it again. Anyway, so we're going to talk about masks and filters this week. And both of these are things that you can place in front of the camera, or sometimes actually behind the lens, or you can also place between the film and in the printer when the film's actually being printed. But they're basically things that are going to block light in some way. And usually they're going to go on the actual camera lens. Now, the mask is the simplest and straightforward. It's basically just a single, some sort of solid screen that just completely blocks all light. So they come in different shapes and sizes and stuff. And probably the most common type of mask is, remember we talked about widescreen and how you could do it? One of the ways was called matting, where you just actually place something that would cut off the top and the bottom of the film. That's a sort of mask, and sometimes they'll be placed actually in the camera. That's called the hard mat, which we mentioned last time, so that either in front of the lens or behind the lens or something, you actually just place this mask that's basically solid black at the top and the bottom, so that now you get a more rectangular image being captured on film. And sometimes it's often just placed before, perhaps in the projector when it's being projected, or when the film is being printed off the negative. Then you put the mat there. That's the so-called soft mat, where you can actually remove the mat later because you do capture all of the image, the full frame image, so you can remove it if you want to, say, for a television showing. So that's probably the most common mask you see today. And you could do all sorts of crazy things if you wanted to with masks. You could have all sorts of weird shapes be recorded. You don't necessarily have to just get rectangles. Most famously, the most famous mask is definitely the iris, which is something you don't see very often at all today, but was very, very, very common in the early days of film during the silent era. An iris is basically a special mask. It's a circular mask, but it can change size, so it can go from bigger to smaller. You'll sometimes hear them referred to as pinhole shots, but the cool thing about the iris was, you know, what wasn't fixed, and it kind of served as a sort of spotlight, or maybe even a zoom before the invention of the zoom lens. You could go ahead and just focus in on a single object by just closing your iris in on that object. And a lot of silent directors use this. It's really common. And you don't see it today, just in part because it's kind of strange. It really calls attention to itself. And like I said, we have the Zoom now, so it's not necessarily as needed. And, you know, also directors are much more willing to break up scenes into more shots than they used to be able to. You know, they'll spend a little more money, take a little more time. It used to be that, you know, you weren't going to do a separate shot necessarily for a single close-up of an object. You just, you know, iris in on that, or iris in on this person to pick him out of a crowd. So those are masks, and like I said, you don't see them too much just because they look kind of strange. But what you do see all the time without probably realizing it are filters. And filters are semi-transparent things that, you know, go in front of the lens or right behind it. And what they're usually going to be doing is blocking some kind of light, but not all light. And they're usually made of glass or gelatin. Sometimes they actually put gels on lenses, that kind of stuff. And the most common kind of filter is a color filter. And what a color filter does is it absorbs a specific color or colors and thus changes the kind of the tones that get captured. So let's say you have a blue filter. This means that the filter is actually made of some sort of, you know, blue plastic or glass or gel or something. Any light that comes through it, it's going to be blocking out non-blue colors. So reds and oranges and greens and stuff tend to get blocked out. Thus, the light that does get captured on film has a very, very bluish tint. And likewise, if you want to make things seem a little warmer, you can put on a reddish or orangish kind of filter. A lot of times this gets used if you want things to look really lush. If you want things to look really cool, you stay with a bluer filter. And they come in all sorts of different textures and stuff. You don't have to have it be really solid. You can have it be very light. Things would look really, really funky if you used a very hard filter. So they're not done often. Though you can actually achieve some weird kind of low-budget special effects through the use of filters. Probably the most famous, you know, Truffaut made a movie with this as its title, was something called Shooting Day for Night, which is using a blue filter to film a nighttime scene. So you underexpose the film, and you use a blue filter, and you shoot during day. Well, what happens is you get this bluish tint, and since you underexpose the film, everything looks much darker than it would normally. So you can go ahead and shoot a nighttime scene outdoors during the day, and it looks funky. The image does not really look like a nighttime image, but if you have a low budget, it's a good deal because it's much harder to film at night than it is during the day. I mean, film is very light sensitive. You have to have a lot more lights. It's harder to do at night. So if you're making a cheap Western or other B picture, which is where you commonly saw these kinds of things, then directors would often just, you know, cheap out and do the day for night shot using a filter. You rarely see this anymore because it looks crappy and we have better film, that kind of stuff today. So it's easier to shoot at night, not as much effort, and also because audiences expect more, I think, today than they necessarily did back in the 60s or so. And there's some other things you can do with filters as well. You could change the quality or the amount of light. And a lot of times this isn't something that's as noticeable as color filters, but just know that, I mean, there's all kinds of crazy filters cinematographers will use to change the way the light looks, to make things look softer or harder. And in a sense, other sorts of things could be considered filters as well besides these. Back in the old days when they wanted to make starlets look even kind of fuzzier, you know, they'd shoot through some sort of really, really fine, gauzy cloth, for instance. That way it would make everything look really soft and kind of hazy, but you wouldn't be able to see any imperfections in the skin of starlets. So when you see some of those close-ups in the 1930s or the 1940s and everything looks really fuzzy, part of that is the film they used back then had that sort of look to it, but also maybe they're actually shooting through this kind of filter that makes everything look soft and hazy, because there was actually a time where movie stars would, you know, in their contracts say, you had to shoot me through this kind of filter for all my close-ups, that kind of thing. Or, you know, the really powerful stars would actually only work with specific cinematographers who could get them their kind of look. And you should also know that some of these things that we talk about with filters are often achieved with colored lights and gels put on lights. So, you know, if you want a blue tint, you don't have to actually use a blue filter. You can just get bluish light, and that will also definitely work with the kind of effect that you want. In fact, that is in a lot of ways probably more common. Filters, you know, it tends to be a little bit harder to adjust it, that kind of stuff. Much easier to use different lights and move them around where you want them, and then you don't have to tint everything. You just kind of tint what you want to be tinted.
And we're back to Movie or Banned, the show where we ask you 10 things and you got to decide whether they're movies or bands. So let's get ready. Stephen Keller, you've already been given the questions. Now let's hear your answers. Number one, Savage Garden. Is that a movie or a band?
Band.
All right, correct. Number two, The Fabulous Baker Boys.
A movie about a couple singers.
Okay, well, okay, movie, good. All right, number three, Trout Fishing in America.
It's got to be a movie.
Aha, that's a band, sorry.
Oh.
Number four, Smilla's Sense of Snow.
A movie.
Yes, not to be confused with 6 inches of snow. Number five, Thanks to Gravity.
Band.
That's a band. Number six, Smiling Fish and Goat on Fire.
Movie.
Yes. Number seven, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
Movie and a much better album.
Oh, you didn't fall into our trap. See, we put the word band in there, and it's not a... number eight, The Doors.
Both.
Ooh, you're dodging our traps left and right. How about number nine, Wings?
Also both.
Ooh, okay. Number ten, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Video game?
You are correct. It actually was a video game.
Yes.
All right. Well, that's 9 out of 10. Not bad. Yeah. All right. I'm going to break character here because there's no way to segue into what I want to say next here just to wrap up. But while I was researching for the questions to ask you on movie or band, I ran across a number of interesting band names that are based on movies. So I'll just run through the list. Rats of Unusual Size. They Were Expendable, Sharon Stoned, The Voluptuous Horror of Karen Black, The Winona Riders, Full Metal Chicken, The Band That Shot Liberty Valance, and my favorite, a band called The Shower Scene from Psycho. I don't know if any of them have any good music or not, but we can draw inspiration from the movies in other areas of entertainment as well.
You know what you should have done if you really wanted to trick me? Was have Spinal Tap, which is a band, because the movie is called This Is Spinal Tap.
Ooh, yeah, I could have done that.
That would have been nasty. I was waiting for it. That's it for this week. Check us back next week, of course. And also, before you do, check back the website at allmovietalk.com, where we have a blog with other discussion about movies. And you can feel free to give us your takes on this week's segments or anything you'd like to see, that kind of thing. So, like I said, the name of the show, allmovietalk.com.
And also check out rinkworks.com for more movie-related entertainment. Next week, hey, it's a big one, episode 40 for July 3rd. So just before you pull out those fireworks, you can, pull them out a day early and celebrate with us. We're going to be talking about the Marx Brothers. Great, great, funny movies they used to make that I think are still entertaining. And Stephen will continue to talk about ratings and censorship. And our top six list is going to be the top six movies that nobody seems to know about. Six movies that we've each found really entertaining and are a little confused about why more people don't know about them and appreciate them. So listen next week for some good suggestions about what to watch.